As some of you may recall, one of our recent speakers mentioned two topics which are always good as conversation stoppers, namely sex and education. I think those were the ones. I think we can safely add a third one, namely violence. This seems to be a subject on which a lot of people feel very violently. In general, more heat than light tends to be created in this area, and there are many puzzling inconsistencies which I'm sure are troubling others as well as myself. The American people are very proud of their revolutionary past, but tend to condemn all current revolutions out of hand. They condemn violence at home, but condone its use by their country in exercising its foreign policy. Perhaps most baffling of all is the fact that a lot of solid citizens today who profess to believe so strongly in law and order are advocating violence in order to maintain it. Well, there's a lot of room for clearing up some of these confusions, and perhaps our speaker for today will do this. I'm working on the assumption that most of you came here to hear Mr. Long speak rather than to hear a very detailed, long biography about him, so I will refrain from giving you one. I will only mention the most relevant topics. I believe he duly received his degrees from a duly accredited institution, Harvard specifically. He then worked for a number of government agencies and taught at a number of very creditable institutions, culminating his career, if that is the word, by coming to the University of Illinois this year, where he is now with the Department of Political Science. And I believe his approach to the problem of violence, as he informed us at the table, will be largely political rather than, for instance, psychoanalytical or various other interesting approaches. Of particular interest, however, to the topic today is that Mr. Long was the first director of the Lemberg Center for the Study of Violence, which was founded at Brandeis University directly after the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Mr. Long's topic for today is the escalation of violence. Mr. Long.
Thank you, Professor Ferber. I'm really very glad to have a chance to talk with colleagues and fellow members of the university community, since all of us have a deep stake in the escalation of violence, even though I suspect that many of us are not effectively engaged in doing much about it. I have the impression from a number of campuses that I've been on of both students and faculty in large numbers acting as if they're on shore watching a shipwreck, which was fascinating, but not seriously seeming to consider that they weren't on shore but were in the boat. And that indeed the capacity to maintain an effective, viable social order is not just the responsibility of chancellors, trustees, or administrators, because professors in this age of an excessive demand for their talent can run and go from one institution to another. And as an academic migrant, I shouldn't even mention that. But that while we don't have German universities, students, for the most part, are not so tied to an institution that leaving it presents a great deal of a problem. But indeed, we have this curious situation of important institutions for which there's very limited commitment on the part of the majority. Very limited commitment indeed. And that there is that term, and I frankly apologize for using it because it's such a fuzzy thing. We have large masses of alienated people who are likely to say, when the place is being torn to pieces, go it man, go it bar, or a plague on both your houses, as if indeed it wasn't their house, as if there was nothing that they could do about it. That they were sort of struck dumb, or if not dumb, and professors are never struck dumb, though they may be that, they were incapable, you know, of any kind of significant constructive action to deal with the situation. Now, I suppose this is a perfectly normal kind of activity on one's part, because one assumes that there's some built-in gyroscopic stabilizer in the ship, that means these perturbations aren't going to be serious, that they're not going to be continuing, that they're not going to go beyond the point of no return. And you know, one is always concerned in this country of optimists to be considered a prophet of doom and gloom. One's always supposed to take the roseate view. You know, you're always afraid of being said that you're either hunting witches or you're seeing bogeymen under the bed. But having come of age in the 30s, and having been in Germany before the Nazis came to power, I have some very uncomfortable feelings of the parallel in this country, both in the country at large and in the university, of the conditions of the Weimar Republic. And I'm interested to see that a colleague who I guess wouldn't be considered to be hopelessly reactionary, and probably by the way we age people today, no longer considered to be a youth leader, Michael Harrington, sees somewhat the same kind of parallel in people who believe that protests, no longer seeming to be effective, are entitled to use disruption. Violence in a good cause is appropriate, and who can say that? Even the daughters of the American Revolution believe one revolution was good, unless they've changed their minds now. Jews who are notorious for their belief in pacifism and amicable settlement find some reason to sympathize with Israel. So that, you know, everybody believes, I guess, that some violence on some occasions are okay. Now, I got involved in the Lemberg Center because after the assassination of President Kennedy, a fair number of the Jewish community were desperately afraid that it meant pogroms. They thought that instead of this being an anarchical act of violence by a single conspirator, that it was sort of symptomatic of a breakdown in the normative structure in the country. And being an acutely sensitive people who have suffered greatly from the outbreaks of uncontrolled violence, these people, you know, had the wind up. And I think their radar may not be all that bad. They may be overly timorous. But they had a sense, you know, that somehow or other the social controls on which we depend for keeping people from letting loose the aggressive narcissistic drives that are basic in human beings, that have been important for the biological survival, in culturally uncontrolled ways or culturally directed ways that can be acutely disruptive of the society. Now, I suspect we have been going through a very long period of what the sociologists call degrouping. We've been debunking most of the authority structure, whether it's the church, the family, the community, all the various things in terms of which people accepted the legitimacy of authority and social control. As a lifetime liberal, I confess to having participated in it. It's only now that liberals have become part of a liberal establishment that they're beginning to see some of the virtues and some of the views of the conservatives. My colleague Pat Moynihan rediscovers the family and discovers, you know, that it's fairly important for kids to have a family and to have a family that is supportive of their educational aspirations, and that if you have a society which has the effect of a human meat grinder on an important sector of that society, then you have a can of worms in the ghetto. And you discover that once you start the process of de-Stalinization, you get the same results in the ghetto as you get with de-Stalinization in other countries. And people are shocked, I guess, as Kosygin and Brezhnev, and as undoubtedly Khrushchev was, to find that when you begin to reduce the kind of system of terror and repression, when you no longer, at least at the level of ideology, justify it, but begin to attack it, people know that something is given. They don't know how much, and you have a radically destabilized situation in which, until you can arrive at some new set of accepted norms as to how to behave, you're going to have probing operations, constant probing operations, to find out just what is given and how much is given. And the same kind of a problem that the Russians find with respect to the reestablishment of some secure and stable base of order once you de-Stalinize is faced by the white community and by the black community with respect to the condition of blacks in this country. And I suspect we're going to have a really rough time, and just as the Russians find that the answer to liberalization is a return to repression and to the use of brute force and the attempt to develop quisling governments to provide a means of control, what the British so elegantly call indirect rule, we have the same kind of problem in these United States with respect to the black community. We're involved in the enormously difficult problem of decolonializing the society from within. Despite the rather utopian views of the communists of the 30s who envisioned a separate black republic, where some blacks have similar utopian views today, it seems radically unfeasible to achieve the kind of classic form of separation that decolonialization has meant when it was possible internationally. You have the problem of how do you take a people who have been used as serfs, bred as cattle, inured to the culture, the subculture that Kenneth Clark describes in The Dark Ghetto, pulverized socially, given the view that their middle class were a set of white stooges or cop-outs, set against each other in such a fashion that the corrosive suspicion that is endemic within underclass Negro culture renders it very difficult for any kind of effective organization. How do you move from that to a stably organized black society that is capable of organizing against resources, capable of bargaining with the white society for a reasonable share of the society's resources, and then on the basis of self-respect and the respect of whites, to become part of a pluralistic society, which hopefully would be enriched in meaning and better as a result of the creation of a new, not entirely new, but of a new in the sense of appreciated, black identity within the United States. Now, the coming to be of an Afro-American society as opposed to simply a black society that is sort of insisted in the white society is a darn painful process. It involves very tough changes. If you consider the lighthearted way in which John Lindsay, with the magnificent advice of McGeorge Bundy, who showed so much sense with respect to Vietnam and so much greater sense lately, although unfortunately too lately, and with too little sense that the earlier sense may have been much worse than nonsense, proceeded to attempt the decentralization of the New York school system. And I think the problems there illustrate the problem that confronts us, because Lindsay was trying to do something that was in one sense eminently sensible. And anybody who seriously wants order in the United States must want effective organization and power for blacks in the United States. You cannot have self-respect and human dignity with powerlessness. You can't teach kids unless you have a neighborhood environment in which teaching can effectively go on. And you can't teach kids with teachers who can't live in the neighborhood. If there's one thing we should have learned from the Peace Corps, it is if you're not prepared to live in the villages and identify with the villages, forget it. You may serve as an army of occupation, but you can't serve as an effective teacher. Now, this is a serious problem because in New York City, over 50% of the school children are black. Over 2/3 of the teachers are Jewish and white. And probably about 90% of the total teachers are white. And what do? You got a labor union issue, you got a class issue, and you got a social issue. And you've got a problem of a weak political system that casts up an attractive young personality symbol as mayor, whose only source of power is the constant attempt to get public opinion on his side through favorable newspaper publicity and through the television. And you depend upon the constant feedback of a popularity contest for a basis for governing. Now, of course, most of us who are liberals believe in government without power. And we believe it should be possible to have government without power. And we also believe it should be possible to have government without force. We condemn Alexander Hamilton, and we certainly have very little respect for the framers of the Constitution, who had an acute sense of the necessity of having power. And we act as if people could be dealt with by persuasion. At least we act as if all people could be dealt with by persuasion, except Southern white citizens' councils. And for those, we appreciate the need of paratroopers and federal marshals. But when it comes to others who are less benighted, whose views we in some sense sympathize with and approve, we say, no. There, you've got to find a way to do it by peaceful, successful persuasion. I don't know what they're going to say when it comes to Lindsay being booed down a Jewish synagogue by Jewish teachers. I don't know whether people will say that these Jewish teachers are fascist pigs or whatever nice epithet one might want to choose to use with respect to them. I happen to think it's a part of a social tragedy that should see two of the most discriminated against groups in American society pitted against each other across the barricades, tearing apart the source of political support for one of the most liberal and probably enlightened political leaders in the United States, with the police and the firemen and the sanitation workers rubbing their hands on the side and saying, now is the time to zero in for the kill. And we'll get ours, and we'll get ours, and we'll get ours. And New York becomes an interesting kind of picture of the debility of government in the United States and the problem of how do you govern by amiable, liberal-minded people thrown up by a momentary popularity contest who have got to somehow desperately stay popular if they're going to whip up public opinion to the point where they can get some acceptance for what they do. Now, it seems to me that as I understand politics, you have to have power to be able to govern. And the power depends upon your being able to mobilize a sufficient degree of support to make your opponents know that they can't get away with it. John Lindsay will be able to face down Cassisi and the Patrolman Benevolent Association if he is able to create more than a loose, amorphous, and transitory public relations majority. If he isn't, he will be beaten by every well-organized group, and the well-organized group is likely to say, well, you know, it's true, it's bad for the whole to operate this way, but in this kind of a jungle, every man for himself and devil take the hindmost. Now, when we have communities that approach that kind of level, you have to ask, are they viable? Can you run a self-governing community in which the majority is so apathetic and so disorganized that it cannot pull itself together to support a political leadership and to give that political leadership sufficient power to be able to tell dissident minorities, pressing their own view, pressing it perhaps with the most self-righteous sense that they are God's anointed, that this is what we're prepared to give you in terms of the going political process, and this is what you will get. We will listen to you, we will discuss with you, but we will not tolerate your use of disruption or violence to upset the political order. And the patrolmen in New York have already, out of uniform, used violence against blacks. They have chanted before City Hall with upraised arms, blue power, and with a fascist salute. I take it very few of the people on the left, even the far left, would regard this as a very desirable example for general imitation. After all, the Patrolman's Benevolent Association has no divine mandate to disrupt the government of New York or to stage a sit-down in the mayor's office. Their views, as to the good, the true, and the beautiful, are quite clearly incorrect. And for them, perhaps it is time to trot out repressive non-toleration. But for others, it's a different story. Now, of course, you cannot have it both ways. You can't have it on the one hand that we tolerate some of it, and on the other hand, we're going to tell the right, you've got to play the constitutional game. When we do that, it seems to me we utterly discredit the position of the liberal moderate. We really say he has a double moral standard, or maybe he doesn't have any at all. And I'm not really so concerned about his moral standard as I am about the consequences. The consequences really concern me. What does it add up to? What is the likely outcome? What happens on the campus if liberal presidents devoted to at least far more procedural decencies in the relationship with faculty and students than we've known in the American academic past, are utterly discredited by the capacity of minorities to mobilize lighthearted, panty-raiding mobs of students to occupy offices and to provide a degradation ceremonial for the reactionaries in the legislature and the good people around the state who say, if they haven't got the capacity to keep their campus in order, we better put somebody in who can. Is it really to the interests of most of us to have these sort of people replaced with the people I think one would regard as most likely to replace them? And does one suppose that the SIU solution that I hear bruited about as a good one is going to be to the advantage of the academic cause? I have some doubt about that. I have very acute doubts about that. Now, maybe it's because being of an age that made me in Germany before and during Hitler's coming to power, but I'm unduly sensitive to the views that were at that time expressed by the communists, who said, look, the only enemy we have are those bland social democrats. The edifice of mud is the Weimar Republic, which has accomplished nothing of any great value. Let Hitler come to power. He'll be there a very short time, and utopia on wheels will succeed him. It seems to me that one ought to think very carefully about what are the realistic options that we have. And I grant you, I find them exceedingly unappetizing. I don't find a single major political choice in the current election one that, to me, looks very attractive. Most seriously, they don't look attractive because we look as though we will not have an election which will make a meaningful decision, which will produce a governing majority, and we don't look as though we had a candidate that was prepared, except at the level of rhetoric, to regard the problems of the country as more than problems of repressing some psychotic minorities. Now, there is certainly a strong point in the case of faculty and liberal people who say that the doings of the extreme left are a fever thermometer of a sick society. I would like to add to this that the doings of the extreme right are equally a fever thermometer of a sick society. I would be concerned not only with infuriated blacks who have great reason to be infuriated, but I would also be concerned with the polls of Cicero, and I would be concerned with the people who support Governor Wallace, who think of themselves as good people. They work hard, they pay their debts, they raise their kids, that they respect the flag, that they're not ashamed of patriotism, that virtually all the virtues that they've been taught to believe were important, they think are important, and they're confused, bewildered, and deeply troubled by a society which seems to sneer at everything they had been taught to believe was valuable and desirable. I would certainly think we have to be concerned with that fever in our society and why that fever is attracting to itself political vultures who are prepared to exploit it. We need an apostolic mission to Cicero as well as to the south side of Chicago. And it's a real pity that white liberal kids feel no vocation for working with lower class whites as well as with blacks. We have to find some way bridging the gaps in this society. And we need to bridge them more than with a charismatic leader. Many of us say, and I think rightly, that if Bobby Kennedy hadn't been assassinated, we had at least had a candidate who would not be afraid to campaign in the ghetto and campaign in Cicero. And the country desperately needs somebody who can speak to both of these sides. But it's a weak country. It's a weak and sick and desperately ill country that depends for its salvation on the life or death of any man. I think we have to ask ourselves, what is it that has basically gone wrong with us since Jack Kennedy was able to ask and strike a real chord in American youth and throughout the country? Don't ask what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Now that has turned to dirt in our mouths in the last few years. It has turned from a time when you could have talked to an audience like this and felt that this country was going somewhere, that the great society was not a fraud, that the civil rights legislation was not just so many pious and empty slogans. And we know fairly well that the destruction of this has been quite measurably caused by the division of the society over a brutalizing and divisive war that, with the best of intentions, the present leadership stumbled into, and we found no way of stumbling out of. Until we can mobilize effective political leadership that can recreate the sense of vision, the sense of possibility in the society that transcends black and white, and working class and marginal middle class, and Pole and Negro, and Jew and Negro, we are going to have a continuation of the escalation of violence. We're going to have this escalation of violence because there are no settled norms that we can automatically take to govern the situation. There are no automatic stabilizers. There is a continuous process for degeneration. There are no bargaining means. We haven't turned the language of violence, as in labor relations with management we finally did, from confrontation, politics, and blows to the negotiating table. We desperately need to find ways of organizing commitment in the majority and across the majority to bring about a return to a willingness to build the society and build it credibly. And this is in no sense an easy thing. Perhaps we far too lightly undertook to raise people's expectations that we were really embarked on a great society, that we really meant a massive social transformation of a caste society. We raised the expectations, and we raised them not only with blacks, but we raised them with American youth. And then we turned them into a fraud. And we are shocked and surprised that people whose lives have been made meaningless should find that the affluence of the contemporary society is no adequate substitute for a sense of purpose and for a sense that they were going somewhere. Now, I suspect that we are not going to seriously deal with the problems of the escalation of violence until we are prepared to work at the job of recreating meanings that can give people, young and old, black and white, some significant sense of purpose. And I think it behooves us right here on the campus to realize that this isn't a job for somebody a million miles away or a job for some political leader. This is a job that can be done right here by confronting the meaninglessness of the American university, the legitimate grievances that kids have because they are not given anything more than some version of the rat race as a reason for doing something with their lives, that academic leadership has to be more than merely the expediential handling of brick and mortar, or the IBM cards, or the legislature, that academic leadership, if it is to survive, has got to lead, and if it's to lead, it has got to have vision, it's got to have credible purposes, it's got to provide occupational therapy for people who have become neurotic as a result of what the society is doing, and it has got to be able to acquire commitment. And that means that the uncommitted faculty and the uncommitted student body have got to be brought into the enterprise with a sense of purpose and a sense of meaning. When that happens, academic administrators will not have to be able to wonder or worry whether four or five people with bullhorns can lead an assault on chancelleries and students with the notion that this is the modern version of a panty raid follow them. They'll have more important things to do. And until they have more important things to do, and we're at the job of doing them in the university and elsewhere, I'm afraid we can expect the escalation of violence to continue. And if moderate liberals have neither the guts nor the capacity to govern institutions like universities, they have very little future in our society. Thank you.